Welcome everyone to another special episode of Kiwi Talks to celebrate the 20th anniversary of Metroid Prime 2, which is also a celebration of how to feel old. I'm honored once again to speak to the producer of Metroid Prime 2, Brian Walker. How are you doing?
Good, good. Thank you for having me today.
Yeah, it's been a long time coming. I've been wanting to speak to you for a while. Because the last time we spoke was back in 2021, and I'm always looking for a good excuse to speak to you. So thanks for taking time out of your day.
Not at all.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask and start off with the relationship you had when you first got in with Tanabe and Otani, because obviously this is probably a whole new kettle of fish for you working with Japanese producers.
While I was at Electronic Arts, I worked a great deal with the EA Japan office, Junji Shota, for instance, and went over there a few times because they were huge supporters of the Ultima Online project that I was currently overseeing. And so that began to introduce me to the, a lot of the Japanese culture and sensibilities in the games industry, even though Shota-san, he actually went to school at University of Texas. So he tempered a lot of things. He already was aware of things that might be difficult to navigate from just a Lost in Translation standpoint. So he was a fantastic, learner contact in the, for the Japanese culture, especially in the games development scene. And that was able to kind of grease the skids into, interfacing really closely with, Mr. Tanabe and Mr. Otani.
Was there still anything that caught you off guard, though? Because obviously Nintendo is its own thing, They're very unorthodox, I guess you could say, in terms of their approach.
The biggest challenge right from the get-go that I had to face was to understand that all dialogues happen at half speed. They speak, it's translated. We process, we speak, it's translated, they process. And that was a much slower cadence than I had been used to in other game development regimes. So that took a lot of adjustment. And it was also quite a bit of, it required a lot of diligence to be extremely clear in how we speak and being sensitive to things that we could say that would be easily misunderstood or difficult to translate. So there was a several month learning curve for me to basically be able to parse back and forth effective communication in that kind of environment.
Can you think of an example? Off the top of your head? Obviously, it's a long time ago.
Something that we would occasionally face during especially more granular design discussions was nuance. When we wanted something to be red, well, are you sure? Did you really say red, or do you mean orange? Or do you mean dark red? Those kind of nuances are really prevalent from what I came to understand in Japanese language. Not just from a purely text standpoint, but from a verbal intonation standpoint. And it was surprising how many conversations we would be conducting that would get tripped up, at least for a little bit, about the nuance of how we were trying to convey a concept.
So how far would that go, though, before it would be corrected? Had stuff been like designed or prototyped before they're like, no, we meant this?
I think the big advantage we had when it came to proof of concepts and prototyping is the design team and Mark Puccini especially were fantastic illustrators. And so a picture is worth a thousand words. So yes. We, when it came down to powers and play features, boss encounters and so forth, we were... Really very proactive in providing Adobe Illustrator images. And that was a huge help when we could boil the concepts and the proposals down to a handful of frames showing this is how something works, this is how something moves. That by itself was worth its weight in gold in many exchanges, especially when it came to boss encounters, which are usually, especially with Mr. Tanabe, very elaborate, very multi-staged. Those being able to demonstrate those to him visually saved us a ton of time.
Can you think of any examples with any of the boss designs? Because I think Metroid Prime 2 specifically is very well known for its bosses.
And that's a testament to not just Mark and his leadership within the design team and his clarity of communication, because he was a fantastic communicator, but also Mr. Tanabe and his fundamental strengths of boss design, pacing, and we would frequently be using the whiteboards. We'd frequently be referring to these design documents that were 90% illustrations and sketching on them in real time to, okay, instead of moving every 4 seconds, add a jump and then move every 5 seconds, those type of things. It was very, very granular conversations. And again, fortunately, very heavily backed by purely visual assets.
So how did you streamline the pipeline? Because Metroid Prime 2 had a reduced timeline compared to the original Metroid Prime, which I think was 36 months, and maybe Prime 2 was 20 months, if I recall.
It was pretty accelerated.
Yeah, so you've obviously got to try and factor in how long you think something's going to take, how much money is going to be allocated, and obviously you've got to factor in curveballs as well. And this stuff is all highly, it's all highly detailed stuff, and there's no way of actually knowing.
That's something I brought to the table, coming from just my prior experience across other publishers and other development teams and genres and so forth, was the importance of every day, tracking every day, identifying what is due from who, when, and what it's dependent on, and helping propagate that understanding across the team. That was not how Nintendo had been making games. That was not how Metroid Prime, the original, was made. And so coming in the middle of a very aggressive schedule, trying to go back and articulate and quantify every step, making every asset, what it looks like, and then start from that work, start taking the metrics out of, okay, this widget takes 11 days, start to finish. It involves four people over those 11 days. This is exactly what they do. This is how long it should take for each of those steps, and this is what it's waiting on ultimately. Breaking it down to that level of granularity and putting together from those individual snippets a much larger production pipeline, top to bottom, of every aspect of making that game. That's what we were also doing on the fly. We were coming up and creating and standing up these processes while we're also running really fast to make a game. That was a real challenge, but not only did it pay dividends in the latter half, the post-production phase of Prime 2, but it was a huge help in the games that we worked on later. The end result was we were able to say, okay, this is how many widgets we have. This is how many people we have. This is how it all comes together. So if we have X number of widgets, X number of people, and we're delivering on time, this is the day. This is not the week. This is not the sprint. This is not the quarter. This is the day that will be done. And that was initially met with a lot of suspicion from our Japanese partners, because again, they had never made a game like this. Over time, we began to demonstrate the accuracy of our projections. If they wanted to add something, or if they needed 3 more days to give us feedback, and we had to kind of hold up on a process, we were able to shuffle other priorities around to fill that time, or we had to help them understand, okay, if you want to take 2 weeks to give us the feedback and we can't proceed in this area, this is what it does to our ending. So giving them that level of transparency without making it sound confrontational wound up to really kind of be one of the linchpins that helped the maturation of Retro Studios from a wild bunch of incredibly talented people to a high-functioning organization. That was be one of the big things I would hang my hat on.
So at the same time, are you trying to help educate the devs on how Japanese culture is as well. Like, for example, Japanese people usually don't give praise to you if you do something right, because there's an expectation that you do it. But that could be misconstrued by, you know, a game developer as, you know, an insult, possibly.
I think that's one of the dangers of interfacing with different cultures, is assuming the cultures are all homogenous and their approaches, their philosophies are all the same. I found our partners at Nintendo and Mr. Tanabe's team to be, they weren't effervescent at any times with, you know, handing out cookies and smiley faces, but they were very forthcoming when they liked something. And they were very supportive of helping the studio grow and providing the feedback, the constructive criticism that we needed to get better. It was never this really cliched, stoic, stone-faced, silver-haired domo who, a slight nod was considered, you know, gushing feedback. No, they were very much high energy, highly focused game developers, and they were really supportive and very straightforward with their compliments when warranted, and also their constructive feedback. They were very diplomatic in that as well.
That's good to know. You did mention before that prior to Metroid Prime 2, they'd never made a game like this. So
never made a game with these production processes.
Right. With those production processes. So do you know what their style was before they'd worked with your tools?
I was a little production pipeline? Amused and a little amused and terrified when I first got there and saw essentially they did everything through Microsoft Excel, including localization.
Really?
And scheduling. It was just all Microsoft Excel. They were extremely good at it, and they, to their credit, they had some good scripts that they were running, but they were basically trying to use Microsoft Excel as a do-all tool. And I remember Risa Tabata, when she first sent me a request for a schedule for what, you know, Prime 2 was looking like, what our high level schedule was looking like. I sent her a Microsoft project file, a Gantt chart. And her response was, I don't know what an MPP file is. What is this? And I'm like, well, yeah, we have some learning to do.
That's hilarious. But I guess it worked for them, though. So were they able to take those learnings and then apply that to their own production pipeline and maybe increase the output of their own?
It was
stuff?
Really, as shortly after we finished Mario Kart 7, we were talking to Mr. The EAD team that we'd been working with really closely. And that was just a fantastic project. They were super interested in adopting a lot of the processes that we had been refining over the years at Retro Studios. When they sent a team over to us, and they were aside from Mr. Tanabe and his team, this was the first time that I had been there that Nintendo had sent an actual development team over, and they saw our environments, they saw our processes, and they were just absolutely giddy with how that could help them out. So I don't know if they went on to adopt that ultimately, but they were really excited and had reached out to me a great deal after that visit to get some of those processes going on their side.
So with Metroid Prime 2, obviously its development went through a lot of peaks and valleys, you could say. But obviously there was the multiplayer at first, and then that got cut down. And then there was all the prototyping with the Dark World, because that changed as well. So obviously you're looking at this from a production standpoint. Were you factoring that into account, all the stuff that was going to be changed?
The goal of production ultimately is to never say no. It's instead to package the messaging in a form of, we can do that. Here's how long it would take. If the date won't change and the resources won't change, then we can't do that. But never, as a producer, is it a good idea to tell people, especially really passionate developers, yes or no. Give them options. And our process that we'd put in place there at the time allowed us with increasing levels of accuracy to give them coherent options, give them the ability to be resourceful in taking working within the constraints that we had, but also being very innovative and achieving their goal through other options rather than just trying to beat something to death with brute force.
I know you had a bit of a input into the Federation Marines on Prime 2, a little bit, but was there anything else you actually had input in from a design standpoint?
Really, my focus, and I was super passionate about the game, but my focus was not to be another chef in the kitchen on the creative side at all. And so I really just sat back and watched people who were incredibly good at their job do their job really well. I would not have been able to add any value to that conversation. They knew the franchise, they knew the game, they knew the market. And I was coming in, from a drastically different environment, working on the Ultima Online and its turnaround at Electronic Arts. So I knew I had a seat at the table, but I knew also, in following some of the best advice I ever got in the Army, was never pass up an opportunity to keep your mouth shut. So I kept my mouth shut.
Fair enough, fair enough. I did want to ask about the marketing campaign for Metroid Prime 2. Did you have much of a discussion in this? Because not at all. Were
Not at
they,
all.
do you know if they were aware? Because obviously Metroid Prime 2, it felt like it was wedged in between two of the most important first-person shooters of all time, Halo 2 and Half-Life 2. So was there any discussions about that at any point in terms of its
No,
release date?
not really.
No.
And that's something, having come from Electronic Arts, which was very, very much a marketing heavy philosophy in how they released and developed games. Coming over to Nintendo, the developers told marketing what they were going to make, and it was up to marketing to sell it. There was no focus groups, which are the bane of my existence. I hate those damn things. No focus groups, no input for marketing about, yeah, we need this to be, darker red. We need this, we're going to do a licensing deal, so Samus needs to carry a purse this time. None of that nonsense. And as a result, I think that's one of the reasons that Nintendo has been so very successful, is because the products are pure. They have the developer spirit driving them. They don't have Wall Street. They don't have Mark. They don't have Beverly Hills that are dictating these tastes. And that's something that, as I've moved through the industry over the years, I've grown to increasingly appreciate. Marketing would send us requests for the assets. I mean, and that was it. And we would throw them the raw files, and they would do all the assets for us. It was never marketing constantly pulling on and saying, "Oh, we need this bitmap. We need this bitmap. We need this screen capture." We just threw them the raw assets, and they did it themselves. And that's a huge, huge help to a development team, especially in the post-production phase when they need to bear down on polishing and debugging the game.
That's interesting because I have heard that Nintendo live in a bit of a bubble and they don't care about what the competition's doing, what other games are coming out. It's not even on their radar.
And as a developer, you don't realize how valuable that is until you see other operations. And I really have to tip my hat to Reggie Fils-Aimé, who came in and was overseeing so much of the marketing. He carried that philosophy on, and they were a support mechanism for development, which is rare in this industry. Sometimes in some areas, it feels like the development teams are a support mechanism for marketing. I think the games show that in many respects. And the Nintendo of America marketing team in particular, Reggie, they knew whatever we were going to make was going to be great. And it was up to them and how to package that greatness and bring it to the public in a way that would get them excited. And they did a fantastic job.
So would Reggie make trips to Retro often?
He not often, but I would say about every 6 to 9 months, he would come to visit. He was, I mean, we just thought the world of Reggie. I mean, truly thought the world. And we were in a corporate, a snapshot in time from a corporate progression standpoint, where we had Mr. Iwata, who was a developer, and he knew how important it was for developers to project their creativity and their enthusiasm into the project without interference. And we had Reggie, who was a, you know, a iconic leader in the industry, and we had nothing but support from those two gentlemen. And so much of Retro Studios' progression is owed to what they provided for us.
Do you remember how well Metroid Prime 2 did? Do you know how much it sold? Did it sell over 1 million units? Do you know?
I believe so. I believe so. It, yeah, it. I don't think it matched the original Metroid Prime. And I don't think it was really expected to, but yeah, at the time it did move solid numbers.
Right. Because also I think with Metroid Prime, the original, it was bundled with the GameCube as well. So that probably inflated sales somewhat.
Yeah.
But did it meet the sales expectations, I suppose, is the main thing.
Those were conversations above my pay grade at the time.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. If there was a Metroid Prime 2 remastered, what would you like to see in it?
Wii controls or motion controls. I would like to see the difficulty, which I've gone on record as kvetching about a few times. I'd like to see the difficulty more even, and an enhanced tutorial for some of the more difficult boss encounters, I would say. There's not a lot I could say. You know, they like to say in sports, you know, leave it all on the field. At the end of the day, when you walk off the field, you have nothing left to give. And I think Metroid Prime 2, given where Retro Studio was in its maturation and its culture and its talent, that was an excellent effort, top to bottom. I can't say, you know, if we'd only have 6 more months, or if we had only been able to do this, if we'd only done this with the multiplayer. I honestly have absolutely no regrets in that regard. Other than, you know, I was still irritated that I couldn't beat the Boost Ball Guardian when we shipped.
But you did beat it after.
I did.
Yeah.
So, that was my great revenge in Metroid Prime Trilogy, is being able to own the Boost Ball Guardian with the Wii controls.
So do you have a favorite boss in Metroid Prime 2?
Quadraxis.
Yeah. Everyone of us has said that. Yep.
And it's a huge shout out to Mike Wicken, who was the primary design force behind Quadraxis, but also I believe it was Paul Tozer, the engineer, who was where the rubber met the road as far as implementing that. I think from the standpoint of just the awesome factor, the size of the encounter, the interactions, the multiple interactions of climbing around on the boss, doing the Shadow of Colossus thing before Shadow of Colossus, I think that one stands probably across the entire Prime series, if not the entire Metroid series, as the defining boss encounter.
Agreed. And you can see
Mike Wicken owes me money, by the way. So yeah, Venmo Mike.
Because even with some of the later games, the 2D games, Mercury Steam, clearly they were influenced by the Quadraxis boss. I think it was with Diganaut, where you climb up it. So yeah, it's still influencing the series to this day with how iconic it was. How much input did Tanabe have in that? Do you know?
Every boss encounter, if he wasn't in at the extreme high concept, and he rarely was not involved at the extreme high concepts. Our design team were really, you know, they held the vision for these boss encounters, and they held the high level goals. It was in when you got down to the nitty gritty, the small details, the timings, the scales, the interactions that you would have with the boss. That's where Tanabe really shone. He just, and I keep saying it in these interviews, he is truly a savant in that area. Boss design was what he was born to do.
So would the designers design it and then he'd kind of come in and just tweak it or apply something to it to really make it shine that much more?
He was a fantastic sounding board. The designers would come with their high concept, three or four pages, mostly illustrations. This is what the boss is. This is roughly what it looks like. This is how we interact with it. This is how it fits in. And that's one of the most important things, how it fits in with the overall progression of the player package, the different capabilities, the skill level the player will have accumulated at that point. We agreed to from the initial concept in the pitch, taking it to initial prototype. And this is something where Paul Tozer, again, was just fantastic. He could create these prototypes so fast that it gave us that incredibly valuable iteration count. How many iterations can you get before something has to be finished? Paul was fantastic at that. And we were doing really rapid iterations, not just on the bosses, but all the content. And Paul, his ability to rapidly iterate on the bosses really, I think, reflected at the end of the day. If X equals iterations, it's how much X you can get on a boss encounter to really fine tune it. And that's what I think set Retro and the Prime series apart.
What tends to be, or the thing that that eats up the most time in terms of the development cycle? I've heard that it's animation, but I don't know if that's actually true.
It's back then or now? Because they're two entirely different. Yeah. Our biggest pipelines back then were environments, by far. We could create an average creature top to bottom in about 3 weeks. That's
pretty good.
From initial concepting to creating the initial mesh, rigging it, texturing it, and coming up with basic animations in about 3 weeks. For example, on Donkey Kong, larger environments, but environments would take 35 days start to finish. That's what we had for those. Some of them took a little longer, some of them took a little less, but on average, we blocked in about 35 days for those. But I mean, now it is entirely possible to burn 4 months start to finish, 4 months start to finish on an average character. When you're looking at the technical art pipeline, the requirements of your blend shapes, your animations, all the rigging, you can spend 4 months easily on an average character and 6+ months on a major character.
These days, yes. So not animation, but the actual art or the animation as well.
I include animation as animation is actually not nearly as far as the overall proportion. Animation is not as big a piece of the pie from start to finish, what it takes to generate a character, as it used to be, mainly because there's the tools have gotten so much better.
Right, I see. Yeah, because it was apparent to me on the Metroid Prime Remastered project when I was watching the credits how many people worked on it. It was like 300 people or something crazy. Yes. And I suppose it's just art that just balloons the budget.
Yeah, it's now, I mean, there are some major IPs in the games industry that have thousands of people on them.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Do you think, I know you've studied some courses in AI, but do you think AI can ever help somewhat mitigate that?
We're at an interesting point in game development. I'm going to say not just an interesting point, but a critical juncture. And we're at the point where games are not cost effective to make anymore.
Yeah, that's right.
A AAA game, even a mobile game, a high quality mobile game is going to cost 9 digits to make start to finish, to take to market start to finish.
Jeez.
Yeah. 9 digits. So every swing is a very expensive and very critical one. And AAA, you're looking at Hollywood blockbuster budget numbers for a AAA game, easily. And the amount of sales that you have to generate from these games at this point is astronomical. And the games are the game, the sales are not increasing as much as the costs are. The expectations for more content, bigger content, more detailed content. And this is as we're kind of, shifting over into the next generation of hardware. This is why you see so many offerings like, season passes and so much emphasis on post-launch downloadable content, game stores and things like that, because that's how you make your money. It's the initial price of the retail or the initial offering that you download to start with, that doesn't cover the budget. And so the games have to have these secondary ongoing streams of revenue to have any hope of being representing a solid return on investment.
I think I remember Mike Wickens saying to me that I think $100 million you'd have to sell 2.5 million units. Is that the rough?
Oh, more than that. It would
Really?
be, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you got to figure out the first party, the first stores where you're going to download the game initially. They're taking 30% right there.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah,
Yeah.
and then if you're that's $100 million budget, you probably have got to move about 6 million to break even.
6 million on a $100 million budget.
Yeah.
And that would be, I mean, if we're theorizing here, would that be all digital sales? Because obviously physical, the retailers take a cut as well, right?
Yeah,
So yeah.
yeah,
And
yeah.
there's the boxes and shipments and so forth.
In general, the retailers take a little more than the digital storefronts for their cut. And then you have other things you have to consider, such as what they call reserve on returns. So if somebody wants a refund, that takes another 15% generally out of the overall bottom line. Those are things that anybody that's saying, look at these massive sales for, super IP A. Once you start doing the numbers, you realize that massive sales are what you have to have to be, even hit the bottom rung of success at these days.
That's crazy. I suppose it makes more sense to me why Nintendo does what it does then in terms of how it. But I've always thought that budgets in Nintendo would be a bit more conservative because they don't have inflated budgets and they don't have realistic graphics and heaps of voice acting and so forth, right? So they're able to keep development a bit more conservative.
Yeah, they there's a genius in what they're doing. And sometimes it doesn't work, but in general, the track record speaks for itself.
So, I mean, I guess from the Metroid Prime or the Metroid series in general, because they've kind of had the same sort of sales constantly over the years, would it be fair to say that it's a bit worrisome in terms of the sales of the franchise? Because obviously costs are increasing, but the franchise tends to just still be selling at the same level. I think Dread sold 3 million, so that's good, but I don't know what the budget was.
One of my probably one of my most influential mentors over the course of my career was Bing Gordon at EA, and when I was part of a mentorship program and got to talk to him a lot, learned a huge amount from him. He's just a fantastic individual. But he was also able to get me in as a fly on the wall into a lot of really high-powered board meetings and director conversations. And I quickly started to understand that even if you can't dominate a space, even if your product is not charting, topping the charts, it's important that you still occupy a space. Even, in chess terms, a pawn at e4 is still going to affect the middle. It's just a pawn, but it still has a presence. And so that presence, even if you can't dominate the middle, it that pawn, that occupation is still valuable from a corporate standpoint. And that's when we start talking about the high level considerations of stock pricing and so forth. So it's having a presence is often just as important as dominating a space with chart toppers.
Right. So even though Metroid doesn't sell on the level of, say, Zelda or Smash Brothers, it's still important to Nintendo, primarily because of what it represents and the genre. And I suppose it represents a different audience, maybe a mature audience, more so than some of the other stuff.
Yeah, it represents a very high quality standard within a more mature audience.
Yeah, makes sense. Cool. Now, I did want to ask, of the game, what would be your favorite area in Metroid Prime 2 in terms of all the different areas?
It's got to be the tech.
Sanctuary Fortress?
Yeah. It's got to be the tech area. One, because it has Quadratus, and I'm a Quadratus homeboy. The downside is, for the longest time, one of the designers had an office right next to me, and he would always leave his dev kit on when he would go home. And he was working on, I think, Michael Chin, if I recall his name correctly. He was working on Sanctuary Fortress. And so I would have that same game loop, music loop, going on Sanctuary Fortress all the time. And it got to the point where I started developing this Pavlovian response, the anime, eye twitch.
Yeah.
Even, if I could, I'd be walking by a kiosk at GameStop, and they, if they had that music, I'm just like, make it stop. So Sanctuary Fortress is my favorite area. I love the digital rain effects. I think those are just absolutely genius. And that's just a testament to the creativity and the, rampant creativity that we had with the environmental artists at the time.
Yeah, every other dev that I've spoken to ranks that as the best area. And I think most of the fan base loves that area. I think it's their favorite. It's definitely my favorite. And it's just a very unique biome in terms of the series overall.
And the diversity of the series, I think this is where the team really started to flex its muscle creatively, is having from the Aegon Wastes over to the Sanctuary Fortress, the diversity, the Dark Worlds, of course, that was a huge testament, especially to people like Todd Keller and Elvin Schaefer's and Ryan Powell, the people who were leads of the art team, and also the muscle in the trenches that could implement these visions. My hats off to those guys.
Hmm. Do you have a favorite item upgrade?
That's a good question. You caught me flat-footed on that one.
Because Prime 2 has some unique item upgrades.
Yeah.
And then obviously implemented the screw attack, for example, from the 2D games.
Yeah.
I've gotten different answers for this, so I'll be interested to see what you say.
I'm going to have to go. Yeah, now that you mentioned, I'm going to have to go with the screw attack because it was the bulk. It was the topic of so many completely ridiculous conversations with Mr.
like what?
Team. Just entertaining. And then, I'm going to get in trouble if I go into detail there. But we had a lot of fun fine-tuning that, and Mr. Tanami's input was really helpful with that. But I'm gonna have to go with screw attack. I think from my standpoint, and I confess that at the time I was not the best with the GameCube controller and playing to Prime 2. I found that particular feature to be one of the most successful and helpful.
It's great, and how they changed it slightly to make it work within the 3D space from the 2D game. So I loved it when I first got it. Do you have a favorite music track from Yamamoto-san?
It's not the Sanctuary Fortress.
I was going to say.
I'd have to say Aegon Wastes. Scott Peterson, who was coming on board as the audio engineer at the time, he loved to say that sound makes your game look better. And I think that soundtrack in that environment proved Scott out. It's a ridiculous comment at first, but then when you think that how complementary the music was with the overall environment of the aesthetics, I'd have to call that out.
I think people underestimate how important music and sound design is to a game. It can really, like, if you're playing something and everything's there except that, then that just changes fundamentally everything in terms of the feel, doesn't it?
Scott, in so many cases, made me look like a better producer than I was at the time, much better producer than I was, because we would inevitably deal with some of these situations where particles and audio are always the last step. And there would be changes that come down the pipe, and really good. They added a lot of value to the game. But that started eating away into the amount of time that particles and audio, Chuck Crist in particular on the particle side, and Scott on the audio side would have to work their magic. And you know, whenever I went to these guys, especially Scott, whenever I went to Scott and say, "Okay, Scott, we were originally, you know, had you down for 10 days here. We can only give you 7. You know, that's what we got if we're going to maintain the schedule." And he never complained about this, and he always delivered at, you know, and ultimately I started calling him out. "Okay, I know you sandbagged the 10 days, you know, we can give you 7 days, which you knew you were going to get anyway." So there was always this fun back and forth that's, you know, from a professional standpoint, but never at any time when we had to take a day or two here from his schedule was Scott anything but supportive. He got it. He was a veteran. He knew how the games industry worked, and he always over-delivered with whatever we asked him to do. He spoiled me. He made me look like a much better schedule manager than I really was.
Well, it's good that you're openly admitting that, because some people wouldn't. That try and hold on to that credit. So
You
that's good of
know,
you to
and
do that.
this is, you bring this up at a point where, you know, in the years before Metroid Prime 2 in particular, we had the celebrity game developer thing going on. I
Yeah.
mean, there were a lot of people who fancied themselves rock stars, who fancied themselves to be genius, designers and so forth. You know, and you notice that people like Mr. Miyamoto and Sid Meier, they were never in that narrative. They never contributed to that. They knew the reality of what it takes to make a truly great game. I'm glad that those days are long behind us, but I'm also super glad that we never had anybody in the team during Prime 2 and on like that. It was always, what can we do to make the game better? How can I contribute to that? It was never, okay, this is what I want. This is what I think we need to do. This is what I am demanding that we do. We didn't have any of those prima donnas on the team, and the overall work was reflective of that.
Well, it's a collective, right? I mean, there are some companies where marketing will employ like a special person to be a representation of that studio, right? Where they do all the PR and then they become the celebrity, so to speak. So, yeah, you're right on the ball. I mean, there was no one at Retro that really got all the praise and all the attention. It was a collective.
And that's one of the reasons I, you know, during these interviews, I really try to call people out by name, because in some ways they didn't get the exposure and the credit that they should have, or and in a different organization they would have heaped on them. But the fact that they have their names in the credits list of a top shelf game as part of a fantastic effort to innovate and to create a top quality product was, it also speaks for their dedication.
And also in the case with Retro, particularly in those days, is there was a lot of overlap in different departments, right? I mean, because AA studios are so big these days, people tend to be isolated to one role usually, where they just focus in on one thing. But you'd have engineers working with the designers, and there might be some overlap, particularly in those days, which is not as prevalent, well, in the big AAA studios these days, because they're just too large.
Oh, Lord. And a AAA game these days is an international effort.
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah.
The dev teams are probably scattered across multiple offices all over the world, and that's not counting your outsource teams, which are going to be, huge, hundreds of artists, be it in China, Eastern Europe, all over the place. It is a massive undertaking. I frequently get outreaches from young aspiring developers still in school, perhaps, or just coming out in the industry, is like, where can I go? I have a great idea for a game. Where can I go to see that game realized? And my feeling is, it's not going to be at on a big IP. It's not going to be at a huge studio. I mean, there are people who can work entire careers in a huge publisher and have absolutely no input whatsoever on how a game from a higher level is going to be navigated. Obviously, they have to focus on, this is my area of expertise, this is where I'm contributing, and make that the best they can, and that will ultimately result in a better game. But the ability to say, yeah, I was a huge part of the vision of this game, no, those days are long gone.
So, knowing what you know about the AAA space, would you want to be a producer at that high of a level where you are basically having to manage teams on multiple continents over various time zones? Or would that just be way too stressful and way too of a massive undertaking?
For a brand new producer, yes, that's a
Yeah.
big ask. That's a big ask. That's what I've done in multiple stops. So it requires a certain toolkit of processes and disciplines to pull off. And trying to manage something like that, against the old ways of making games, that would blow up horribly. But now it's a given. Now it's part of every high functioning producer's skill set to be able to manage around the clock across the continents.
Now, I have some questions from the community. Maybe you can answer them, maybe you cannot. We'll see. We'll see how we go. But yeah, so I'll pose some questions to you. So this one is from Lark Yark 3261. These interesting names, I gotta tell you. What inspired the general darker direction and what inspirations they had for it? I'm assuming Alien.
I honestly don't know.
Because
I can't, I you know, and I was in all of the design conversations. I was in, and I can't honestly recall anybody saying, yeah, this is the look that we want to go for. This is the theme that we want to go for. I mean, we knew that there was Dark Samus, the teaser at the very end. The next step for Dark Samus seemed like a theme that should be contributed. But as far as the overall look, I honestly can't remember saying, yeah, we need it to be just like this game. Or in some of my conversations that I had when I was at EA, okay, it needs to be edgy, but not too edgy. Don't make it too edgy. No, I'm going to have to bunt on that one to coin the baseball term, because I can't really recall anybody saying, yeah, this is why we want to be darker, or this is why we're choosing these themes.
because I know Nintendo doesn't like when you compare, when you're trying to make an idea known and you start comparing it to other games, right? Like, oh, we this should be this feature should be like this game or that game. They like to think of everything in isolation, right? This is an original idea.
We would have a lot of fun conversations with Mr. Chinabi about that, because in addition to being game developers, we were huge Metroid fans and huge Nintendo fans going back to the days that Game Guy. And it's hard to innovate. It's hard to present a new idea when people are so encyclopedic with their recall of everything that Nintendo has done at that point. So people like Kynan, and Mike and Tom, Mr. Tanabe would come up, he would think, and it's like, okay, why don't we try that? And they're like, oh yeah, just like this game, just like Doki Doki Panic. And they're like, oh yeah, that's right, we did do that. So it was, yeah, these guys knew their stuff top to bottom. And yeah, Nintendo, of course, had been such an innovative force for so long up to that point, and of course through that point, there had been just a bucket full of fantastic ideas.
Good to know. Next question from Jalind Sa, I think it is. Was there any directional guardrails from Nintendo?
Not that I recall.
Not really recall. Okay, cool.
That's we work with a variety of IPs, obviously with Mario Kart, with Donkey Kong, and with Metroid. And I don't really recall anybody coming up to us on the course of Metroid Prime 2 and saying, okay, this is your do's and don'ts. This is what can or cannot be discussed or presented or created in the game. It was with Donkey Kong, for instance, we did have areas, what Donkey Kong could do. And they made sense. But I don't really recall a guardrail system for this game. It's like obviously we had to keep in mind things like ESRB ratings and things like that. So
Yeah,
you
of
couldn't,
course.
yeah. So that goes without saying. But no, I don't recall that.
What about anything from a law standpoint? Because obviously, I'd imagine Sakamoto would be very protective and be like, because he obviously had ideas for where he wanted to take the series. And this is far before Metroid Dread, although I'm sure he probably had the genesis of the idea floating in his mind somewhere. Obviously, the lore, I mean, it's one of the few Nintendo franchises where the lore is coherent, right? It follows a linear progression and it seems to make sense. It's not like the Zelda timeline, which is all over the place. So I was just wondering if Sakamoto said anything at that point in time, or was it just little nudges?
We actually interfaced very little with Mr. Sakamoto during Prime 2 compared to Mr. Tanabe. So I'm sure that they have some conversations in the home office that we were not privy to. But we rarely got any do's or don'ts from Mr. Sakamoto. Our Mr. Tanabe and Risa and Akira Otani were our primary handlers in that regard.
That leads into the next question, actually, which is from Captain Dodge One, if that's how you pronounce it. Are there any lore details you remember that you especially remember thinking these are really, really cool? I actually really like some of the Federation lore.
Now that's one thing I've called out in prior interviews is I always was hoping to explore the Galactic Federation more. I think for such the assumption is it was such an expansive presence across a largely unquantified galaxy or area. What is it that they really do, and how can we build on that as a backdrop against what Samus is going through? But I think one of the, yeah, I on the lore questions, there just wasn't a lot of introspection about what Prime 2 is that I recall about what Prime 2 was doing to advance or fit in within a more overarching lore.
Well, you do want the Federation to be featured more, and it looks like, possibly from the Metroid Prime 4 trailer, that the Federation will be featured in some regard. So you did kind of get your wish, but.
I'm very stoked about that. I'm looking forward to. They haven't called me for a voiceover, which I'm disappointed about,
Oh,
but
yeah, because you did
very
one in Prime 3, didn't you?
exactly right. Yeah.
Well, just because we're on the subject, what were your thoughts on the Prime 4 trailer?
I'm really fascinated to see how they handle Psylux. Even going back to Metroid Prime Hunters, Psylux had emerged as a rival, potentially a deadly adversary to Samus, and his emergence in what admittedly is a tease for his presence in Prime 4 opens up a lot of really cool options. You know, is he, you know, Samus has been the benevolent bounty hunter. You know, is Psylocke more, you know, like a real mercenary type, you know, cutthroat bounty hunter? What we do, you know, how does he oppose Samus? Where's the beef between those two? How did it start and how will it end? You know, is Samus going to be the one that's, you know, ultimately bleeding out at the end of the game, or is he going to continue to be a growing presence, much like Dark Samus across multiple SKUs?
That is a good question. I suppose we'll find out in due course. But Tanabe was talking about Psylocke for years prior in terms of wanting to expand on him. So it's funny because obviously Sakamoto had the idea for Dread ages ago, and obviously Tanabe has had this in the back of his mind for years as well. So it's interesting that they finally get to see what they want come to fruition.
I honestly lost count of how many times we would have people literally showing up at our front door asking what we knew about Dread.
Really?
Oh yeah. We on several occasions we'd have people knocking on our front door who were huge, you know, Metroid Prime fans, you know, wanting a tour, or you know, had some questions, wanting to win a bet and so forth. Yeah, it was fun.
Would you let them in or be like, no, this is
We,
off
yeah,
limits?
usually, yeah, usually they got to pardon me. Usually they got to the lobby, and that was as far as we could take them.
Is that
But as
because,
and
yeah, but is that because of that message that's in Prime 3? You know, Metroid Dread is close to completion, but I think I remember Mark Bacchini saying that that was just a coincidence.
it
It was
was an
never intended.
absolute coincidence, and we that was a coincidence. We've said it a million times, and people still refuse to believe it.
Well, people just, yeah, they want to get conspiratorial. That's funny.
Yeah,
Yeah.
as I said in an interview going way back then, it's like, yeah, we're not that clever. We can't be that subtle.
Yeah, because you guys are obviously kept in your own bubble as well, right? So you would have had, I think, because Metroid Zero Mission released the same year as Metroid Prime 2. And there wouldn't have been any, I suppose, communication between the two different teams.
Yeah, no, not at all. Not at all.
Yeah, because you guys were kept in your own bubble.
Yes, very much.
So it's like an invisible wall that's around you guys. So, well, I mean, I might have to get your thoughts once Metroid Prime 4 releases, because obviously this is a long time coming. And
I'm really excited about it because
yeah.
I know how hard those guys are working on this, and I just hope I would I'm honestly hoping that it just recalibrates the standard for the Metroid Prime games.
Yeah, and I hope it sells really well. I've always felt that Metroid deserves more sales considering the impact it's had on the industry and how critically acclaimed the franchise is. It's always been held in high regard on the same level as Mario and Zelda, but the sales have never quite reflected that. Yeah, and obviously we've seen with Switch how massive Zelda's become now. So, but it'd be cool to see the same thing happen with Metroid, but I guess time will tell.
I agree. Fingers crossed.
Yeah. Before I wrap up, do you have any final thoughts or a favorite story or a funny story from your time at Retro?
So many. And the nostalgia is just flooding over me at this point. Working with so many, not just talented people, but genuinely cool, fun team members. And that's, I think, you know, my big takeaway from Retro Studios is the value of a great team. It easily surpasses the value of a bunch of superstars.
Yeah, that's a good way of summing it up. A lot of the devs have said that it was the best team that they ever worked with, and that there will never be another studio with that caliber again.
It was just again a snapshot in time, a bygone era, really. Now teams are so spread out, so huge. You just don't have that opportunity to sit next to somebody and communicate at a cerebral level. That was a luxury that we had there. Regardless of what department they were in, regardless of what team they were in, we had, when I got there, it was 43 people. When I moved on, it was 73 people. Most AAA projects now have more producers and product managers than that on their projects. So it's, yeah, it was an era where a studio could make a great game. And I'll miss that. We'll never get that back.
Yeah. Well, even now, Retro Studios, I think, has might be 150 people, which is still kind of small in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, it
Yeah.
is.
But I think, and you'd probably know, but once you get to a certain level where you've got a lot of people in a game studio, then communication can sometimes be lost because you're dealing with managers who manage managers, and then you have to funnel information through multiple people for it to get to the right person, right?
Yeah, the demands for administrative overhead at that point become exponential.
Yeah. Cool, Brian, this has been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for taking time out of your day away from the toxicity of the American election that is upon us all. But I very much appreciate it. Do you have any final thoughts before I wrap it up?
Again, I am here as a representative of a fantastic team. That's all I'm doing.
Yep. Brilliant way to put it. Cool. All right. That is the show, everyone. Make sure you share, like, and subscribe. And until next time, stay safe.